Hey, do we all remember when Democrats called Trump a
fascist?
Fascist.
Fascist.
He's a fascist.
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 Do you think Donald Trump is a fascist?
Yes, I do.
But then
Trump has been elected.
The cheers coming up.
And then
I'm going to work to find common ground with the Republicans on how we can do that.
We fought like heck on where our values were assaulted or challenged, and we'll continue to do so. But that does not mean we will not aggressively look for common ground.
After yet another most important election of your life, Democrats have neatly tucked away the F word and are, once again, excitedly collaborating with the Trump admin. If this was your first election, I'll tell you right now, this isn't new. It's not the first time we've seen Democrats call out Trump's fascist tendencies for election brownie points before quietly backing his anti-immigrant, pro-business policies once the show's over. And there are 1,000 different explanations for this trend. We could try to understand it by looking at exit polls in specific districts, campaign donations in key races, or by focusing on whatever Fetterman is doing. But I think the best way to understand this comfortable alliance between liberals and the far right actually comes from looking a little farther back at the last 100 years. The last century is full of moments where liberals fall in line behind right-wing dictators. The U.S. pushed fascists into power in dozens of coups. The German center, national, and Christian right parties all folded for the Nazi party, and so too did the Chilean Christian Democrats line up behind Pinochet. If we want to actually understand this link, though, we'll need to go even further back. Moments like these all came in the last few minutes before far-right leaders took over, and focusing on them makes it seem like liberals are only ever forced into supporting fascism when they have no other choice. And that's just really not true. Liberals kinda love fascism. Not all of it, not always, but they do like what it can do for them. And to really see that, we should start with Brussels in 1920. Howdy friends, JT from the future here. I just wanted to take a quick second to do a shameless plug for Means TV, both because it's awesome and because being a dirty communist on YouTube is looking like more and more of a losing proposition. If you're not familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos to original series like Means Morning News to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. I've been working behind the scenes to help turn Means into a place that's both worthwhile for viewers as well as offering financial security for socialist creators in an increasingly reactionary political landscape. Every creator on the platform has a unique link that when anyone signs up using that link, that creator directly benefits from the subscription. I have mine in the description below, but if you really appreciate another creator's work, make sure to use their link instead. All of us at Means are trying really hard to build an alternative media ecosystem that is ideologically dedicated to sharing left-wing perspectives. With Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and fans right on the platform. As a little thank you for watching our channel, if you sign up with our link, or another creator's if you prefer, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get the whole year 20% off. A full year of Means TV will run you less than $90, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using a creator's link is directly contributing to the financial stability of that channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Means TV is entirely grassroots funded, and it always will be. So if you'd like to help support our work, consider signing up for Means TV using the link below. It really does help the team here at Second Thought and dozens of principled socialist creators across the platform. Thanks for your support. All right, back to the video. World War I completely transformed European politics for a million different reasons. For starters, because of the war effort, most European countries sort of gave up on free market capitalism. They realized their survival couldn't depend on business owners and their profit-first priorities, so governments took over, organizing production, foreign trade, resource allocation, labor markets, bringing tons of private companies into the public's hands, and guaranteeing a new baseline social welfare while also dropping the gold standard to free up government budgets from artificial restraints. they needed to get things done. Surviving the war meant dramatic changes, and those changes actually had some pretty interesting consequences. Not only did they fundamentally undermine the widespread idea that free market capitalism was this all-capable, perfectly functioning system that's in tune with the very essence of human nature, because if it was, why bother with all this stuff? But also, by getting the state explicitly involved and making it super obvious just how much of the economy is just random autocrats calling the shots, governments completely destroyed any idea that capitalism and its hierarchies had anything natural or democratic about them. Instead of the market, you now had a very clear idea of specifically which people were deciding what happened to you. And rather than being forced to do stuff with the threat of unemployment, and whatever percent the government thought was acceptable, workers were suddenly being disciplined by the state directly if they didn't comply with the war effort. Meaning once it was clear to most people that you didn't need the profit motive to get things done, and that governments could run economies to send thousands to die, workers organized so that they could use these same powers to instead make their lives better. And wow, did they organize. In Italy and Britain, for example, worker strikes reached unprecedented scale. 35 million workdays were spent striking in Britain in 1919, and 2.5 million workdays were spent striking in Italy in April of that year alone. To give you an idea, 1919 and 1920 are, affectionately, called the Red Years in Italy for just how popular communism and socialism became at this time. And with that came new attempts at doing the economy without capitalists. Just like what was happening in the Soviet Union, Italian workers organized in factory councils, managing hundreds of factories and industries like agriculture much more democratically, and turning huge chunks of the national economy away from the profit motive. Not only that, where capitalists were still around, workers went on strike for the same comforts as the upper classes, like social insurance for sickness, disability, and old age. And thanks to all these efforts, not only did things massively improve, their wages went up. Like, a lot. 2 times in Britain and almost 5 times in Italy compared to what they were before the war. Now, not everybody was happy about this. Workers getting their fair share meant more and more of the wealth created at this time didn't go to business owners, like it usually did. And I don't have to tell you that that's a really good thing. Only a teeny tiny 1.7% of Italians were capitalists, but they were getting about a third of the wealth produced in the early 1910s. Most of the population was working class, so the fact that capitalists ever kept more than 1.7% of the total pie was a highly unequal thing. But hey, whoa, look at this. Look what's happening there after 1922. That's interesting. After a few years of money being spread more equally thanks to workers striking and getting a say in things, that 1.7% in Italy is suddenly making a lot more of all the money. That's fascism. That right there, that's Mussolini. Wait, I forgot about Brussels. Shit. From September 25th to October 8th, 1920, Brussels hosted the International Financial Conference. This conference was attended by economists, but also bankers and treasury officials, and hardly anybody representing workers. Hailing from countries across Europe, these wealthy technocrats came together to discuss the fact that capitalism wasn't so hot anymore, that it was digging into their profits, and that people were starting to feel just a little too hopeful that their lives might improve as they were getting rid of it in more and more places. They were eager to go back to business as usual, but to quote a financier who attended, "The manual workers were encouraged to expect and do expect some new way of life, some great betterment of their lot. These changes, they believe, can be achieved if the system of private industry is replaced by a sort of government or common ownership." Something that these workers had started proving could actually work. But that's not the point. What sort of a better life were people hopeful for after the war and rationing? According to the report Brussels issued, very basic things like superfluous, excessive consumption of butter and sugar. Basically, the proles were making too many cakes. So, naturally, these jerks decided it was time to invent a new kind of dictatorship. Enter fascism. To restore business owner status at the top of society, they needed to engineer a new economy that would arbitrarily punish workers while making it seem like this was an objective necessity. And they had a few ideas. You might have heard of them before. It's a package of policies called austerity. In six short words, work hard, live hard, save hard. An austerity economy is one that tries to get you to spend more time at work, producing more stuff, making less money, while cutting your spending so that the stuff you make goes straight to exports. This makes your life worse, but it does make rich assholes richer. They're encouraged to save and reinvest their money. Meanwhile, you're chastised for not saving money you don't have because less is coming into your pockets. To achieve this, economists wanted to use three tools: fiscal, monetary, and industrial austerity measures. In their wildest dreams, governments would start by 1. Cutting social spending on health, education, and housing. 2. Increase taxes that mainly hurt workers, like VAT taxes on everyday goods, while at the same time lowering income and wealth taxes so that the rich pay less. 3. Increase the interest rate. This benefits capitalists with enough money to lend out, since now doing so is more profitable, and it makes borrowing money more expensive for those living paycheck to paycheck. It also usually makes unemployment go up, which goes very well with 4. Privatizing and selling off state assets at bargain bin prices, deregulating away workers' rights, and going on a union-busting spree. This was their dream, an opportunity to try out what they called pure economics. More accurately, economic policy that doesn't have to contend with what workers want. An economy where every human can be completely isolated from each other, preyed upon by those with more power, and made to work as much as physically possible before collapsing and being replaced by someone completely interchangeable from the economist's point of view. Whose dream was this exactly? These guys. Here are four Italian economists. Two of them committed fascists, the other two committed liberals. All of them were committed to the same project of pure economics, and when workers got in the way, they felt perfectly comfortable with the dictatorial power it would take to implement and sustain their ambitions. Because the problem is that it's hard to convince people to accept policies that'll make their lives objectively worse. Once austerity is locked in, of course, you don't need to convince anybody anymore. They have no other way to survive than to work inhumane hours, live frugally, and save as much as possible to make it to the next month. But before things run on autopilot, it was going to take a little muscle to get people on board. And that was what Il Duce was for. This is the argument Clara Mate makes in The Capital Order, the book I've been referencing throughout this video. That was her graph earlier. She's the one who found all those quotes. According to Mate, fascism wasn't just a fascist project. Historically, fascist parties were never popular with a majority of the population. No, fascism was first and foremost a technocratic project that brought together both the far right and liberals intent on testing out their economic theories to protect the capitalist system from the rising tide of communist support while making them and their buddies richer. And Mussolini was the guy to deliver on those technocrats' ambitions. Unlike liberal leaders, Mussolini was happy to give these technocrats key roles in his fascist government, happy to clear the path for them by massacring communists and unionists, and happy to allow their technocratic attacks on the working class to take shape. To illustrate how bad this was, during the fascist years, unions were crushed and workers' salaries were slashed so dramatically that workers' earnings in 1946 fell all the way back to what they were 30 years earlier, in 1911, before those five times gains we talked about earlier. And these economists couldn't be happier about it. Pantaleoni, one of the fascists, frequently talked about using the fascist stick in an extermination war against the socialists. No surprises there. Fascists are anti-communists. But Ricci and Einaudi, our liberals, were equally enthusiastic about fascist repression. Writing in The Economist, Einaudi applauded their fascist government for stepping in when the worst happened. Meaning by that, the fact that workers who set up councils in factories took the first steps towards replacing capitalism with communist democracy. The purges, executions, arrests, and complete obliteration of communists and socialists and the impoverishment of the Italian working class were applauded and egged on by top liberals looking for a return of excessive capitalist profits. The state changed its priorities to make capitalists richer at workers' expense, limiting its spending to handouts for factory owners while workers slowly starved. Exploitation and unemployment increased, consumption went down, and fascism was there to keep everyone in line with its black shirts and hide that exploitation under the guise of national duty, stoking patriotic fervor to shut up socialist-minded workers. And this didn't stay within Italy's borders. Like I've said, these gentlemen had a platform in The Economist, a British magazine, to sell fascism abroad. But even without official representatives, magazines like The Times whitewashed fascism as simply, quote, an anti-waste government. And there are 100 more examples of sweeping the fascist violence, anti-Semitism, and anti-worker policies under the rug. In Germany, too, the Italian project didn't go unnoticed. Basing himself off of Mussolini's March on Rome, Hitler attempted his own putsch to gain supreme power. His timing wasn't right, though. He had to wait about a decade, with the Weimar Republic beginning its own journey into austerity politics following the Wall Street crash, for a terrified Hindenburg to appoint him and his capitalist-backed party to the chancellorship. The 1920s scared the German ruling class into austerity. Knowing how violent it would be for German workers, protecting the German upper class's profits required the same cocktail of patriotism and economic duress we saw in Italy. And there was Hitler, sailing in as a political entrepreneur ready to capture public anger and steer it away from the communist direction, tempting Europe away from capitalism. Under his rule, collective bargaining and strikes were outlawed. Unions were abolished. Socialist literature was burned. Communists, socialists, anarchists, and trade unionists were imprisoned and executed alongside Jewish people, black people, queer people, Slavs, and the disabled, protecting the system of profit accumulation from the challenge of popular unrest at a horrifying human cost, quashing all democratic hope but delivering capitalists protection. Here's the truth. Liberals are never forced into fascism. To them, fascism is just another means to an end. During what they might call the good times, when workers aren't organizing too much, not making a fuss, they get to set up more and more of their pure economics and slowly make your life worse. But once those conditions become unbearable, once the hope for an alternative starts to grow, once workers start carving out an alternative for themselves, suddenly the nightmare of true democracy scares them into violence. Once the indicators start going down and the boss gets nervous, suddenly all the violence the state is capable of becomes invisible to them. Shooting protesters, locking up union leaders, censoring the free press, racist dog whistles becoming explicit hate speech, as long as they can get the numbers they care about going up again, it's all the price we have to pay. It just won't be them paying the price. It'll be you and me. Fascism never scared liberals like it should scare you. As long as they benefit from the fascism they enable, liberals will never be on our side.